I'm happy to share a treasure today in the hall, which is my friend Tracy G. will be giving teachings today. She's been meditating for the last 20 years or so, mostly in the Thai tradition from the forest tradition from Thailand, and the last 10 years or so combining Open Dharma with that, as well as letting her practice take over her life, including now most recently working with adolescents in distress. So, thank you.
When I realised that I'd been meditating for about 20 years, I had this thought, I should have got somewhere. And then I realised that it's not a linear thing. It's like you don't start somewhere and get somewhere. Like, there is nowhere to get. But along the way, even though it's not linear, there is a way. We have times when it's just like this chaos, like there's no direction. It's like... And I think... Today I'm going to talk about like what has brought me here, and maybe particularly those times when, as Rumi said, in the last something like I think I might be paraphrasing, in the last mercy of love, God will take you in all directions to lead you to the directionless, and that's. Yeah, that's what it feels like. And also, when Jaya asked me to talk today, I, you know, had to think about, of course, what I would talk about. And I think, well, in writing, they say, whoever they is, write what you know. And so I feel like it's the same here. I'm going to talk about what I know, which is some of my experiences. And I don't know whether they also say, write what you love, but I'm going to talk about also what I love, and that includes some stories, some poems, and some amazing people I've met on my journey. And another thing I read about writing is we write not to be understood, we write to understand. And it feels like to me, this is part of what's happening for me today, it's like talking about whatever it is I'm going to end up talking about, and it's possibly going to be more for me than it is for you, but maybe not. What I so wish that I, because there's so much that I feel like I could like talk about, and I kind of wish I could just go, bah! And like all of it just come out, and then you can all just pick out what kind of applies to you or what you would love. So, but I'm not going to do that, although I'd kind of like to make some bird noises or something. So, I'm from New Zealand, so I'm aware that I have an accent, so if you have any trouble understanding me, do politely interrupt. And in New Zealand we have this really beautiful tradition at the beginning of any talk or meeting or kind of any occasion where people get together, is that we always start with a karakia and a waiata, which a karakia is a prayer and a waiata is a song. So as some of you know, I kind of like to sing, so I'm going to put the two together and sing, and it's also a prayer of sorts, which I will talk about. Ta tangi mai, kia ori ori mai. Ta tangi mai, kia ori ori mai. Waiata tia ho, ki te papa kainga. Waiata tia ho, ki te papa kainga. Whakatukuna tia ki te aroha. Whakatukuna tia ki te aroha.
When I knew that that was going to be the song that I was going to sing, it became really clear that this chant song is kind of the focus or core of what this talk is going to kind of always come back to. And I really, I will tell you about the song. It's, I don't know where to start even to talk about it. So what it means, it's in Māori, and I wrote it in English, and then I had a good friend translate it for me in Māori. And what it means in English, and obviously what it means in Māori, but the translation is different, it means sing, sing, sing me home, surrender to grace. And what my friend did when he translated it is so unbelievably stunning. He's used three different words for sing. And the first one is ta tangi mai. Tangi is to cry. And when you go to a funeral, what is a funeral in Māori is a tangi, and it lasts 3 days. So for me, like ta tangi mai, it's like a lament, like a like calling, crying out to come home, to come home, to come home. The second word, kia ori ori mai. Kia ora is a greeting, so there's more joy perhaps in this kind of, you know, here I am, take me home kind of feeling. And waiata tia ho, waiata is a song, so it's kind of more a traditional sing. The other truly stunning thing he did was this word home, so it's ki te papa kāinga. Kāinga is home, papa is earth or ground. So he knew what I was getting at, so he's translated it as sing, sing, sing me to my earth home. So he's not, like, he knew that it wasn't like sing me to 42 Aperahama Street, which is where I live. It's like sing me home, like home, home, home. And it kind of accidentally, I just started singing it one day, just playing with my guitar, singing a different song, and then thought, oh, this is really cool tune or whatever. And I played around with it and got that, and it was like, wow. For me, it's like, wow. And that, I wrote that in 2012, and I realised also when I was kind of thinking about this, about talking today, is that 2012 was like this really, so much happened in 2012. So I think I'm gonna, yeah, just start by talking about what happened in 2012. At the end of 2011, I had chronic insomnia. Like I felt like I didn't sleep for months. And then early 2012, I did a 10-day retreat with Ajahn Viradamo, who was my first ever Dharma teacher, like in real life. I'd read books, but and he's from the Ajahn Chah tradition. And he had been in Canada for many, many years looking after his mum. And he came back to New Zealand in 2012, and I was so lucky to sit a retreat with him. And I had a kind of insomnia relapse when I had doing the retreat. And then not long after that, I came to India. Again, and went to
the retreat in Madhuban, which was at an Aurobindo ashram. There were two 10-day retreats, and that there was something about the place. It was it kind of changed. It changed my life, you know. And when you look at it, look back, it's like, wow, yeah, that place is like where something really happened. There was, from the ashram, we could look out onto this big, like, long, dry stream bed. So it must have been March, and it was in April. And there was something about, and even now I can feel it, this dry stream bed that really somehow drew me. It's like, and I couldn't quite get what it was, but it felt like I could lie down in that stream bed and be that stream bed somehow, and be that landscape. And the dryness was, it seemed like in that dryness there was this thirst, and at the same time a quenching of the thirst. It was so, like, in my body, it was just amazing. And when I went back to New Zealand after the retreat, I was kind of in between jobs, and I stayed at the Thai monastery, Forest Monastery, where I spent quite a lot of time, and I stayed there for about a month or so. And I rediscovered the Jinshin Jitsu book that I'd kind of seen in their library a few years before, but just didn't get it. And then when I went back to the monastery and I found this book and I read it, and I absolutely got it, like I just so got it. And then I eventually moved back into my flat, and my work that year, I only ended up working 3 days a week. And it's amazing how life kind of does this, like it kind of set me up to just have 3 days work a week, which was fine, it was enough. And for the other 4 days of the week, I would get up super early in the morning and I'd make coffee and I'd just write, like I wrote, and I wrote like crazy, writing. And then I'd walk, and then I would, I discovered audiobooks, and I discovered Stephen Fry reading Harry Potter on his audiobooks, and I would listen to Stephen Fry reading Harry Potter, and I'd lie on my couch, and I'd do Jinshin Jitsu, and I'd just cry. It's like, this has got nothing to do with Harry Potter, why am I crying? And it was a crazy, crazy kind of time. This just makes me laugh now. In Jinshin's, in this book, they suggested six flows that you could do. Well, they recommend that you do a day that are really useful. And in my kind of zeal and naivety, I guess, I did like all of these six religiously, the whole thing, both sides, every day. Like, and it was like, it was took so much time. It was lucky I only worked 3 days a week. but it was transformative, you know, it was so, I don't know, it was just incredible. And so that's when these words, sing, sing, sing me home. And the last bit is surrender to grace. The word aroha is grace, and it also means love, which I really like as well. And it feels like what Jai was talking about over the last few days about finding our soft spots, and earlier, maybe it was last retreat, watering the roots. It's like the same thing. How do we sing ourselves home? And it's like absolutely necessary to find our ways of singing ourselves home. Because home is singing to us as well, like we're singing and we're being sung. Home, Papa Kāinga is singing to us, like inviting us, begging us, weeping, wailing, telling us, come home, and it's like this amazing kind of dance that happens. So it may not be singing, it might be singing. It might be writing, it could be dancing, it could be walking, it's definitely got to be some crying. It's there has to be, there absolutely has to be. And this is what we do. this is this life. So I've been super, super lucky in this path, this journey, to have met some really wonderful teachers and read some amazing teachings. I did my first 4 or 5 day retreat in 1999 with Ajahn Viradhamo, who I mentioned before is a monk in the forest tradition, and he'd trained with Ajahn Chah in Thailand, and he's still alive, an amazing teacher and just amazing monk. And he was the abbot at the monastery in New Zealand for quite a long time, and then he left in 2002 to go to Canada to look after his mum, who was at that time, I think she was 86, and he thought, and everyone thought, oh yeah, he'll just be gone a couple of years, he'll look after her, she'll die, da 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 da, he'll come back. 9 years later, she's still alive, and being so well looked after by her amazing son. And one of the things that I always, whenever I think about Ajahn Viradhamo, one of the things he often used to say was, there's nothing to get, and there's nothing to get rid of. And it sounds so simple, doesn't it? It's like, there's nothing to get, and there's nothing to get rid of. And it so is. It's like, there isn't. We think there is. We think there's enlightenment to get, or there's some kind of state to get, or there's some kind of truth to get, or there's some, what's that terrible word they use in that tradition? Defilement to get rid of. Oh my God, I just can't stand that word. But there's defilements that we have to get rid of. It's like, oh, nearly swore. You know, I can't be doing with defilements. There's nothing to get rid of. There's nothing to get rid of. So yeah, that, when I think of Ajahn Viradhamo, I think, yeah, there's nothing to get. There's nothing to get rid to get rid of. And it's like, oh, huge, huge sigh of relief. So yeah, he was my first kind of in the flesh Dharma teacher. I'm going back again to this Tatangi Mai, sing me home thing. In New Zealand, in Māori, there's a word called Turanga Waiwai, which means a standing place for your feet. Waiwai is legs or feet. And it's to have a Turanga Waiwai is vital. It's vital. We need somewhere to stand. And it's got to be in our papakāinga, it's got to be in our earth home. And another thing that I just adore in Māori is the word whenua is the word for land, and it's also the word for placenta. It's just giving me goosebumps. It's just that important. It's so amazing. And when I was thinking about this, I'm a nurse, and I've worked a lot with teenagers over the years in various kind of settings, and the first ever job I had as a nurse was in sexual health, so I've talked a lot about sexual health, contraception, and when I was thinking about this Turanga Waiwai and the papakāinga and the whenua, like, I had this really strong feeling of the womb, and during the cycle, the womb with hormones and stuff, it builds up all this extra kind of blood and nutrients in the intention of taking care of a fertilized egg. So it creates this amazing bed of deliciousness for the fertilized egg to implant or embed, which I really love this word at the moment, embed. It's like this feeling of embeddedness. And I had the same feeling of the really strong feet on the ground, like really strongly embedded in the womb of the earth, the womb of our lives, that's so feeding us. Like it's that's what it does every single month. It's like, I must get kind of bummed out sometimes. Ooh, nothing's happened this time. But every time it's like, yeah, come on, we want a baby, we're going to build up all this amazingness. And that's what it does. And it's so, like, you know, we don't have to think about it. We don't have to say, oh, can you, you know, hormones, can you do this, da, da, da. It happens. And it's there and it's ready and it's available to kind of take, well, not to kind of, to absolutely take care of this fertilized egg, this baby that's going to grow. And that's what it feels like to me. It's like our earth home, our and our feet, like are just being pulled, being sung into it. And the other thing I thought of was, or had this feeling of, was Sita in the Ramayana, where she comes out of the earth, like the fur, you know, when they, what do you call it? Plow. Yeah, and they, isn't Sita the furrow? Yeah. So she comes out of the furrow in the earth, and she goes back. She goes back into the furrow of the earth. And that's the same kind of amazing feeling of going back. And I imagine Sita, and you know what? I think Sita got, she got a raw deal, in my opinion. Anyway. And I can just kind of imagine her thinking, bugger this. You know, I'm going back. I'm going back where I belong. Because she was kind of, yeah, she got a raw deal, in my opinion. If I was here, I'd have done the same. I would have gone back where I belonged, into the earth. So, yeah, there's the same feeling. And of the earth welcoming her. Like, we're being welcomed. We're being... I might just have a drink of water. You know, I got to laugh because I'm just going to show you something. This hanky, right? My dad, I'm going to get the giggles. My dad died in the year 2000. And this is hanky, and it's this like random thing. It's the only thing I've got. And it's kind of fitting because he made me cry a lot. So anyway, I've got this hanky, so. And it just made me laugh. It's and I have to say also, a lot of things make me laugh. And I've realised over the last few days about finding a soft spot and this feeling of intimacy is I can always make myself laugh, you know? I think I'm really funny. Like, I do. I think I'm really funny. And so there's this feeling of sweetness when I see something or hear something that tickles me, you know? And I'll kind of smile inside or I'll... And it's just such a sweet feeling of intimacy and communication with myself. And also when I've been thinking about what I'm going to talk about and thinking about some of the experiences that I've had and just reflecting on some of maybe the less happy times or, you know, the more difficult times, and there's been this feeling of, like, deeply connecting to me then and kind of, like, this feeling of just a little bit falling in love with me. You know, because of that, the intensity of what I've experienced and, you know, the sadness and the being absolutely blown apart and torn apart and thrown in all directions. And I can, you know, it just blows me away, and I do. It's like just not in an egotistical kind of way, falling in love. It's like, ooh, I'm so great, I'm going to, you know, I love me. It's like deeply, deeply, deeply falling in love with me. And I think that's so important. It's so important to have that deep tenderness and love that's so huge, and it's like a baby. Like if I think of, reflect on difficult times in the not that distant past, you know, it's just like really gathering myself in and just and loving me so much, and also bowing to that integrity of staying with myself. Yeah. I want to have a drink of water. when we were getting or helping Anetta with the retreat, getting organised, we somehow talked a little bit about Bodh Gaya, and I sat the retreats back in the day in Bodh Gaya in 2005 and 2006 and 2007. That's where I met Jaya in 2006. And then in 2008 and 2009, I helped to manage the retreats there with Chad and Karen. And when, you know, when we were talking about that, and then when I was thinking about that, what the memory that came more strongly was when I went to Bodh Gaya at the end of 2004. And 2004 was when I went to India for the first time. And I'd tried several times to go to India before in 1987. Yeah, it was that long ago, when I was travelling with my then boyfriend, who was ended up being my husband and my ex-husband, father of my baby, son. We were travelling and we were going to come back to New Zealand via India and Nepal, and I got pregnant and it just didn't seem like that great an idea to go to India, so didn't go then. And then again in the year 2000 I was going to go with my dad, who was born in Allahabad. He was an Anglo-Indian and he moved to New Zealand, or his family moved to New Zealand after partition. So he'd been back a number of times, and I was going to go with him. And then he got really unwell, and so he wasn't going to go, so it's like, oh, I'm not going to go. And then I decided, yeah, I am going to go, definitely going to go anyway. And then he died, and it's like, no, I'm not going to go, it's too hard, you know. So, and finally, in 2004, I got to come to India. And I went to Calcutta. I spent most of my time in Calcutta working at the, doing voluntary work at the Missionary of Charity, and then I needed a break from Calcutta, and so I decided to go to Bodh Gaya for a couple of weeks. Now when I say, well, I had no idea, man. So I went to Bodh Gaya, and this was at the end of 2004. It's just after Christmas, I think. Yeah, and so I went there, and I had no idea what to expect. And I arrived, you know, super early in the morning. You know, got off the train in Gaya. Oh my gosh, is there any more dire place in India than Gaya? got to Bodh Gaya and went to a guest house and checked in, blah blah. And basically, for the next week or 10 days, I think I was there. All I did, I would get up super early in the morning and go to the stupa, go to the tree, and I just sit there for hours. Like, I sat for hours. I'd get there and there'd be hardly anyone there. And God, when I think about it now, it's like, oh my God, that was staunch, man. But I just sat there. And then I'd open my eyes and I knew people had arrived, but then there'd be like all these people. And I'd have been sitting for maybe 3 or 4 hours. It's like, oh man, I really need to pee and I really need something to eat. So I did this day after day, just sat and sat and sat, or walked around the stupa. And I so wanted to be the guy who swept. You know, there's a guy who sweeps around the stupa. I wanted that job. It's like, I could do that. I could just sweep around the tree all day. So that was really, that was an amazing time. And then I went back to Calcutta and I got back and I was there for a few days and I thought, nah, I'm going back to Bodh Gaya. So I got the, you know, the next train back to Bodh Gaya. And in that, it was probably only 4 or 5 days that I was back in Calcutta, but in that 4 or 5 days in Bodh Gaya, like, it suddenly got really busy. When I'd been there before, maybe because I was mostly at the tree and hanging out in those tents, I don't think I even talked to anyone in that time. Anyway, when I went back, it just seemed really busy, and I thought, ah, I'm not going to be able to do what I've just done. So I went for a walk down the other side of the village and I discovered the International Meditation Centre. And I so wish I could remember the monk who ran it then. He was this really gorgeous, I think he was Bengali. And we had this instant kind of connection, and he had the same birthday as me. He was born in the same year as my dad, but we had the same birthday. And he told me that I reminded him of his sister-in-law. And there was just something about him that I really liked. And basically what they did there was they had like rooms and they had bells throughout the day so you could just do a retreat there. And so the first, and it was quite hard, like it was quite, I think the first bell was at 4. So you sat, walked for an hour and had breakfast, lunch, and you didn't talk to anyone. There was one other guy there who was doing it. So it was like a really supportive environment, but it was quite stark. And the food was really bad. And I was paranoid about the water. It's like, oh my God, am I going to get sick? And but anyway, I did this for, I think it was about 8 days. I did this quite strict kind of retreat, and I think one of the things that got me through that 8 days was I would often do walking meditation in the garden, and there was a gardener there who he had the sweetest face. He had the sweetest face, and when I every time when I walked past him, he'd be doing the garden thing, and he'd look up and he'd see me and he'd say, "Namaste, Didi," and it just blew me away. Every time, "Namaste, Didi," with this shining face. It just was so gorgeous. It was so gorgeous. And he never missed the opportunity to say, "Namaste, Didi." It was so beautiful. By the end of the 8 days, I'd kind of been hankering, like having these huge cravings for the three C's, which were quite prominent in my life at the time: coffee, cookies, and cigarettes. So the last day, I think I had breakfast, and I was just itching to get out into Bodhgaya to kind of satisfy these cravings. So I was really set, I was like, I'm going to go out, I'm going to have a cigarette, I'm going to have a coffee, I'm going to eat some cookies. So I went to the closest cafe and I ordered coffee and got a packet of biscuits, and maybe I just bought a pack, I don't know whether I bought one cigarette or a packet. And I sat there, and I can still remember it so clearly. I swear to God, I didn't know what to put in my mouth first. It's like I had biscuits, I was trying to smoke, and I had the coffee, and I burnt my mouth. Seriously, I burnt my mouth on the coffee, and I was like, smoking. It was so funny. And so I don't know whether I ate the whole packet of cookies, probably I did, those little packets. Drank the coffee, smoked maybe one or more cigarettes, and then thought, okay, now what? And none of that craving, it was kind of semi-satisfied, but really it wasn't. And then I kind of looked around and thought, man, this is so busy. Like I realized it was a Sunday, and there was like lots of Indian tourists, and Bodh Gaya was crazy. And I thought, what am I doing? I can't be here. So I walked back to the monastery, International Meditation Center. First, I missed the turn off because it was like so much going on. It's like, where is this place? I don't even know where it is. I've got to get back. And finally found the place, and I didn't leave for the next couple of days. Like, oh, no way. I'm not leaving again. So this memory was triggered the other day when when there were the forest fires. And I was reminded of one of the Buddhist teachings that I really love, where he teaches to the, and I just love this term, the fire-worshipping ascetics. I just love the idea of a fire-worshipping ascetic. So the Buddha teaches, gives a teaching to the fire-worshipping ascetics, and the first thing he says is, everything is burning. Everything is burning. Our eyes are burning, our ears are burning, our nose is burning, our tongue is burning, our skin is burning, our mind is burning. It's like burning with the desire, the craving, the clinging. And I just love that, the feeling of knowing, yeah, everything is burning. This whole human, it's like grabbing, grasping for the cigarette, for the coffee and the biscuits. It's like burning, burning, burning. And it's so unsatisfactory. It's so unsatisfying. And we keep doing it. We keep doing it. We keep doing it. Until we don't. Until we don't. And that's the translation of nirvana, or nibbana, as they call it in the Thai tradition, is putting out the fire, quenching the fire, quenching the thirst, putting out that fire of of craving, of desire, of getting the cigarette, the coffee, and the cookie all at the same time. I love that, and I love how, in the version that I was told, was when the Buddha said, "Everything is burning," the fire worshipping ascetics were like blown away, that their kind of the way or their tradition was kind of it was confronting for them. It was confronting, and we need to be confronted. We do. We need to be confronted. I knew none of this would actually work. When I went back to New Zealand in 2005, after my first trip to India, my whole life was like, it felt like it had just been blown apart. And I cried for probably 3 months, and it just, that kind of naivety of, when I think about it now, that naivety of just having gone every morning and sat under that tree and not really knowing what I was doing, you know? And maybe that was when the burning, I don't know, you could say the burning really started, or the burning started to be put out. And I think as the burning begins to be put out, there's like such a reaction in the body, and our lives, well, my life got kind of tossed up. And then, of course, I had to go back to India again and again and again and again and again. So lucky. So that was 2004. In 2008, when I went back to New Zealand after being in India, I was really tired. I was so tired, and I was staying at my mum's, applying for jobs and thinking about where I was going to live and where I was going to work. And then I decided just to go to the monastery again in Wellington, just for a couple of weeks. And this was must have been in early May. I'll go to the monastery for a couple of weeks, just have some chilled out time, and then I'll be ready to get back to work and blah blah. 6 months later, so I ended up living at the monastery for 6 months, and that was during the 3 months rains retreat, or vasa, that they have in that tradition. So from July till October, it's a really super quiet time in the monastery where they don't have many guests, and the guests are all really encouraged to be really quiet and meditate, and it's an amazing, incredible time. And so over this period of 3 months, I had maybe about, I think I had 6 weeks, like we would have turns, the other people who were staying, we'd have turns at being on retreat. So we'd just stay up in our cooties, and I met one of my best ever friends, Jamie, who's from Canada. She was staying at the same time, and we became amazing, like really incredible friends. So she, when I was on retreat, she would bring me the meal and leave it for me and leave me little poems. And so I had about 6 weeks of retreat, and it was a really intense time again. And this is so crazy to think about it now, but I became really kind of obsessed with prime numbers. And what would happen is I could have all this quite intense stuff happening in my body and memories and stuff. And the only kind of, well, the what was actually my friend Peter, who was a monk, had been a monk, he said it was like a skillful means, was that I would have to work out all the prime numbers between 1 and 1,000. And I would go through and I had this kind of system of figuring out prime numbers. Or I'd do kind of difficult multiplication, like I'd do the 29 times table or whatever. And 30, and I particularly like the 29 and the 31 times table, but mostly it was prime numbers that I just adored. Like I'd pick a number, it's like, that's got to be a prime, and then, you know, work out it's not. And all the time I was doing this, there was this kind of stuff happening. It's like, no, prime numbers, duh, you know, I've got to think about prime numbers. And then it got to the point where I remember one night sitting in the sala in meditation, and I just thought the words prime numbers. And I had to lie down, you know, it's like, because it just triggered so much. And even now, I love a good prime number. Or a, what do they call them? Like a pseudo prime, where it looks like a prime. It's like a sneaky, ooh, I'm a prime number, but I'm not. Oh, gosh. So that was an amazing 6 months. And it's funny, isn't it, when we're in something, it's like when we're in retreat, we don't always recognise what we're in. And then it's the same, you know, when I talk about, or thought about that time in 2004, 2005 when I was in Bodh Gaya and being at the tree and being in that retreat centre, and then thinking again about 2008 and being at the monastery for that 6 months, it's like, oh my gosh, that was amazing. That was incredible. And what an amazing gift to be given and gift to receive, you know. There's something about being ready to receive that time and that the gift of being in that incredible place. The monastery in New Zealand, if you ever go to New Zealand, it's unbelievably beautiful. It's so beautiful. Yeah. And super accessible, but yeah. So that was 2008. And 2012 I've already talked about. And the other thing that in 2014 I went to Dhammaloka. And I was there for 3 months as the kid.
They may not know what that is.
Oh, Dhammaloka is in Spain, and that's where Jaya's just was living and has left. So I went to stay there as a caretaker. And what I was, when I was thinking about, when it just, this memory came of, again, this feeling of, when I talked earlier about, and I'm sorry that this has been such a random, like, oh, there you go. When I talked about the stream bed and how that, like, this visceral feeling of being that thirsty and being that fulfilled and being that stream bed. Dhammaloka was a similar place. It's like this incredible, so amazingly beautiful and like deeply physically moving, this in it. I don't even want to say energy, it's such an overused word. Like the feeling of that landscape was so strong. And I was thinking about, they had a big tent put up. It was a big round tent, and it had been up maybe all summer or something. And then we took it down, and it left this beautiful, beautiful, perfect circle that was dirt because the grass hadn't been able to grow. So there was this absolutely perfect dirt circle. And I think it was the day Jaya had left. Anyway, I was going to be at Dhammaloka on my own for the next 10 days or so, and I just happened to walk past the dirt circle and saw this dirt circle and thought, oh my God, I have to dance in that. I have to dance in this dirt circle. So I got my iPod and you know, tucked it in and put it in the things, and it was, I think it was around 5 o'clock, so the light on the ridge was just stunning. And I just danced like this, had my best swirly skirt on, and I just dance like this crazy person in this dirt circle with this light and with this landscape. And it was, you know, I can see now it's another way that I was being sung home into the dirt, into the dirt, into the dirt. And being welcomed by that landscape, into that landscape, into that womb of that landscape, into that dirt, into that dust. And so at every opportunity when there was nobody home, I would dance in this dirt circle. And because there was no one around, I'd sing really loud and, you know, with the headphones in. You think you're singing all right, eh? But I don't think you are. I don't think you're singing a tune. But I would dance and I would sing really loud in this. And contained in this dirt circle, that was the other thing. I was contained. And there's that feeling of being contained, but also the spaciousness of that environment and the welcoming of that environment and this being sung home by that environment. It's a really beautiful, when I see it now, it's a really beautiful, like the metaphor and that freedom of dancing in that dirt circle and that freedom of being welcomed by the dirt, the joy of being received by our papa kāinga. And the papa kāinga is not, it can be anywhere. Our home, our earth home is anywhere. And I feel so blessed, so lucky to, if I feel into, like think about or go to, I don't even have to go there, to the monastery in New Zealand, and it is my papa kāinga, it is my whenua. I can't get off the plane in India, even in Delhi, and it is my whenua, it is my turanga waiwai. My feet belong here. And Dharmaloka, and Bodh Gaya, like I have these feelings, it's like I can close my eyes and that can be, it sounds crazy, but my body can be that, is that, it is, I can feel Bodh Gaya in my body, probably because I breathe in so much of it, the pollution and the dust, but it is, it's like this amazing, incredible feeling of being welcomed and I've just had a I've just had a flash of Ben Winston. I met Ben and his partner Emma in 2006 in Bodh Gaya. And Ben and I, and Emma and I, but first Ben, I became really close to Ben. And mostly we got quite close at Saranath after the Bodh Gaya retreats. And we kind of bonded over coffee and sneaky cigarettes. And being kind of bitchy and mean, you know, we were like, oh, Dhamma Sangha, blah, blah, blah. And but it's one of those people. And I think, truly, I think we're so lucky in our sharing of the Dhamma that we meet the most amazing people who, you know, we so easily and so quickly have a connection with. It's so beautiful. And so Ben and I, we got to be really good friends, and Emma and I, and then they came to visit me in New Zealand in 2006, and they stayed with me there. And then we hung out again in 2007 in India. And then in 2013, Ben organized the first Himalayan Yatra. And I'd been, like, in 2012, I told you I'd been doing lots of writing and walking. And where I lived in Stokes Valley, where it was just 10 minutes away from the monastery, there was the most gorgeous, like, big ridge where you could walk in the forest. So, and I walked, I decided I'm going to do the Yatra and I'm going to do it in bare feet. So I would walk for hours in the forest bare feet, and my feet got, like, amazing, like, super, super tough feet. And so I came to India in 2013 and met up with Ben. I can't remember when we'd last seen each other, maybe 2009. But it was instant, like this instant, like, we'd probably Skyped and whatever, but there was this instant just falling back into this really deep and sweet, sweet friendship. And I did the Yatra with him and of course the others. It wasn't just Ben and me, it was all the others. But and I did it. There's only, I think, one or two mornings when it was cold and maybe was hailing that I wore socks, and I didn't even have proper shoes. I admit I had sandals. But I did the whole thing in bare feet. And it's kind of a really treasured memory, not in a, oh, I'm so tough, I walked the Himalayas in bare feet, but that the feeling of being so close to the ground and so close to the earth, and the Himalaya being, you know, the Himalayas are Himalayas. It's like, come on, it's a Himalaya. And it does, you know, it comes through. And so Ben Winston's like, he's this amazing guy. And he died last year in September, really suddenly. He was only 39. And I guess I just feel like I needed to say his name. And whenever I talk about Ben, even to Emma, and Emma's the same, we always talk about Ben Winston. It's never Ben, it's like Ben Winston. And I just needed to say his name, Ben Winston. He's one of my treasured friends that I've met in this journey. And it's you know, the Buddha was asked by Ananda, something like, you know, the spiritual friendship must be, you know, half of the spiritual life. And the Buddha says, no, Ananda, it is the whole of the spiritual life. A sangha is, our friendships deeply, deeply matter. And not just with each other, but with ourselves. It's like going back to what I was talking about before, about the falling in love with ourselves and falling in love with the self back then. It's like that deep connection of sangha with ourselves. I feel like I just have to say, hey, Ben Winston, because I think he's somewhere. I think he's here. And there's another memory that's come up over the last few days with Jaya talking about the body-mind and that unconscious response that happens before the thinking mind. Actually, there's two things that came up. One of them was a few years ago, my son had moved to Australia and he was coming back for his 21st birthday. And we hadn't seen each other for about 9 months, and that was the longest I'd ever not seen him. And I went to pick him up at the airport. And I was sitting there, and I had these kind of flashes of, remember when he was a baby, when he'd been born, and it was back in the day where the babies got put in the nurseries, so you wouldn't have the baby in your room at night anyway. And I remember being so exhausted and going into the nursery, and this nurse was feeding this baby and with a bottle, and I said, "No, my baby's not. I'm breastfeeding. Don't bottle feed my baby." And she said, "This is not your baby." And then I remember going to pick him up from school, and all these kids would be coming out. It's like, oh my God, which one is mine? You know, it's like, oh, we're not going to recognize him. And of course, you always do. Anyway, I was waiting for him to come out. I was waiting at the airport for him to come out, and there were all these like kind of doppelgangers, it seemed like, coming out. They all looked like him. It's like, is that him? No, that's not him. And then before I knew it, I was standing up and walking towards this boy coming to me, and it hadn't even had the thought, there's my boy. I was moving towards him, and bless his heart, he came towards me, and he was like almost out of breath, and he said to me, "I ran." And oh my God, he's so awesome. But yeah, just that feeling of I knew, like I didn't even have that, like the I didn't even connect to the thought, there's my boy. It's like I was moving. It's so beautiful. And the other story and a similar thing, but kind of not as nice. I don't know why I have to tell this story. Anyway, I was staying at my mum's a couple of months ago, and I was asleep, and it was super hot. And in my sleep, I picked something off my arm and threw it. And what woke me was this sound of something landing on a plastic bag. And I kind of woke up and thought, oh my God, what was that noise? Where am I? It was completely dark, and it was hot. It was really hot. It's like, oh, what was that? And I didn't know where I was, and then I kind of figured out, all right, it's right, I'm at mum's. It's like, where's the light switch? You know, so I found the light switch. And then in New Zealand, we have this insect called a weta, which this was a weta that I'd felt on my arm. They're about this big, and they're kind of brown and hard shell. They're kind of like a little mini lobster. They're really quite scary. And they have these really super long antenna. So basically, I had felt like if you, normally, if you feel something crawling on you, you brush. You don't pick up and throw. And I was asleep. And it just amazed me. It amazed me that I knew to pick up and throw, not to brush. It still is like astonishing. And this, oh my gosh, this weta was huge, man. Oh my God, I was sitting on the bed like sweating like anything. And the weta was there. I was like, what am I going to do? And in my mind or in my memory, wetas move really slowly. Like I didn't think it was, you know, it was kind of stuck behind the plastic bag. I thought, okay, I'm going to go and get a jar from the kitchen and I'll put the jar on, get some paper, do the thing. And so I went and got the jar. And I moved the plastic bag, and it moved really quickly. It was like freaked me out. This is like at midnight. Anyway, I don't need to go into the whole weta story. But yeah, just the whole picking up, throwing, not brushing. How did I know? How did I know that? So cool. you know, I could just sit here and just talk. Which is kind of funny. Because I didn't talk till I was 4 years old. Maybe I'm catching up now. All right. Okay, I want to end just with two poems that have been really meaningful for me along the way. And the first one I discovered in 2004 by T.S. Eliot, and it's part of Four Quartets. And I may end up, because I don't have it written down anywhere, but I think I remember this portion of it that's so significant. And he said, I said to my soul, be still and wait for the darkness to come upon you, which is the darkness of God. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope of the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. And the darkness will be light, and in the stillness, the dancing. I especially love the line, there is yet faith. And I think for me it's like the turning point, the fulcrum of that part of the poem, and I have it tattooed on my arm. And the other poem that I discovered, I think it was in 2008, by Wendell Berry. We love Wendell. also about the dark. Actually, just before I say that, it was in 2008, because I had this kind of fascination with the dark as well as prime numbers when I was at the monastery. And I went through a phase, it must have been when I was on one of my retreats, when during the day in my kuti I would draw the curtain so it would be dark. And in the night time, I would open all the curtains so the dark could come in. It's funny what we do, isn't it? So this poem by Wendell Berry. To go into the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark, go dark, go without sight, and find that the dark too blooms and sings, and is travelled by dark feet and dark wings. I'm going to say it again because I like it. To go into the dark with the light is to know the light. To know the dark, go without sight, and find that the dark too blooms and sings, and is travelled by dark feet and dark wings. I think I'll stop here. But I think I just have to sing the song again. Just because I like it. And it is, it's like reminding ourselves to sing in whatever way we sing, to sing ourselves home, and to hear and to recognise and to know that we're being sung at the same time. We're being sung home, we're being called home, we're being called home all the time. We have to listen. Tatangi mai, ki ori ori mai. Tatangi mai, ki ori ori mai. Wai atatia ho, ki te papa kainga. Wai atatia ho, ki te papa kāinga, whakatukunatia ki te aroha. Whakatukunatia ki te aroha.